Mr. Hutton really left, and you were telling me about how you went into the Arab Quarter and you heard rumours. Most of them were rubbish, but one got you into trouble.
Yes.
What was this about?
Well, there was a rumour going that a lot of Germans had landed near Apollonia. It was a very lonely sort of beach way off the road, which was quite sensible in the fact that it's where they would have landed, because no one would have spotted them. And if you were an Arab wanting to make up a good story, that would be a good place for them to land. Anyway, we talked about it and decided not to report it. Now, as we were on the roadside there, a lot of people used to, driving by, used to come in as they were going by to have a drink of tea and spend the night, and that sort of thing. You see, people didn't know from Adam, but it was miles away from anywhere. The army was... Oh, ever such a long way up. Well, two red caps. Well, they weren't red caps, they were transport police, called in to spend the night with us. We gave them something to eat, and they spent the night with us. And whilst we were talking about these rumours, you know, which... And this, evidently, this policeman, he was a colonel, he'd got two stripes. I think he thought it was serious. We didn't realise it was, you know. And so when he left us, he went and reported it. You see? And so there's a terrific flap on. It happened some armoured division of ours had pulled out for a rest or refit or something about 20 miles away. Was all called out to come and go and look. And there was aircraft up, looking around, and all sorts of things. And we realised there was a flap on, and we didn't. I thought, oh, my God. It sounds as though this rumour was true after all, you know, and we hadn't reported it. And somebody else must have done, you know, that sort of thing. We weren't particularly worried. But then when they found out where this rumour, they traced it back to us. This red cap had said that we'd told them. Well, we hadn't told them, we'd just been discussing it and decided it was a load of rubbish, and this chap had been under... Well, you see, all these chaps had come in for a rest and a refit, you know, and these aircraft, cost a lot of money, and we had to... do a bit of talking to get ourselves out of that.
Were you there much longer after that?
Hmm?
Were you there much longer after that?
Well, yes, still went on doing this wine job, but there was quite a bit of trouble about that. I mean, it wasn't our fault. I think they finished up with the red cap getting into trouble in the end, not us. And I told you about Roger Keyes coming, didn't I? His brother coming. And then we had to go off after some Arab, you know, who lived right out in the desert with camels and little tents and whole sort of tribe of them. Well, it's been about 20 or 30 altogether. And the three of us went there, and you had to go off all this arrangement of sitting there in the tent, having a horrible meal with them, and it was not polite to eat what they gave you. And we understood that he was one of these pro-German type of Arabs. But it was his brother we were really after, because he was supposed to have handed over a British airman or something. I was very vague about all this. And we were trying to find the whereabouts of this Arab's brother. But they didn't like us, we didn't trust them. You know, we're sitting there with Tommy guns very near. And, you know, I think we really thought they would have done away with us if they could. But they were very smooth and double-talked. It wasn't a very friendly meeting. He told us a lot of lies. We think he was lying where his brother was. He said hadn't seen his brother for I don't know how long. And so, I know so really, that was another waste of time. Nothing happened, but it was quite interesting. We really saw how the Bedouin Arab lived. They did all this wine drinking. Now, the next thing that happens is it looks like Tripoli is going to fall. And we'd got to go to Tripoli to catch somebody. We'd got to be in Tripoli as soon as it fell. You know, we'd damn nigh got to be in there with the recce group and that sort of thing. And with the three of us I think our motorbikes were all loaded into a 1500 weight truck, that was it, and all our kit. We're all in this, there's three of us in this 1500 weight truck. We took it in turns to ride in the back, and we were put on what was called the Golden List. I think it was a Golden G or a Red G that on our big letters painted on the windscreen.
What did that mean?
That gave us priority, because you've got to remember, when you've got an army advancing and there's only one narrow road, we got priority because police, there were red caps holding up everybody, you know, but nobody was to stop us, so we kept going, and you get to a hold up and the jam, and we were allowed to go round in front. The whole idea was to try and catch the front up, because we were well far back, you see. And we're going along, and we came to a hold up. This time it wasn't held up, we were in front of the red caps and everything. We'd got the road had been blown somewhere, and the road had been blown, and a vehicle, it had to go round off the road, and it was a bit of a waddy. And it was not a bridge, it was more a culvert. And so we had to get off the road and go round like that. But there was a truck in front of us had done that, and it got stuck. And so I got out with the tow rope, and walked out with the tow rope to hook it onto this truck that was stuck, you see. Try and pull him out backwards. And we couldn't pull him out. But there was a tank behind us. I think it would be one of those Grant tanks. That's the one that won't. They couldn't swivel round, right around like a Sherman tank. Was the tank that came out before a Grant. And he told us to get out the way, and he'd pull him out. So I unhooked our chain and put the other tank onto the tank and back onto this thing, this little truck that was stuck. And the tank drew forward, because the chain wasn't quite long enough to reach. It drew forward a bit. I stood back and it drew forward, and it went on over a mine and blew the tracks off. And I must have been walking about on top of that damn thing before it went off. That shook me a bit. And we carried on and carried on. And
After that, you got the truck out, didn't you?
Well, we got this truck out, the tank soon. Well, no, the tank didn't. The tank was there, broken down. But anyway, we got away from there. And what happened then?
You were moving towards Tripoli.
Yeah, we went there, and we were getting that, and on we went, because we got this, and nobody stopped us. But then we got, there was nobody there now. We were all on our own. And we stopped at Mash and Tea, and we saw an armoured car, Green Bay reconnaissance chaps. And because we kept hearing rumours, and we were in a hurry behind. We kept hearing that Tripoli had fallen, and we kept pressing on, you see. We'd had this hold up with this lorry that was stuck, and we kept pressing on. I thought, we're not going to get there in time. Well, we carried on, and there was now we didn't realise, but we were right up near the front. and there was nobody about. You see, so we stopped, have a mash and make some tea.
With this half track or whatever it was.
No, we came across it was a sort of armoured car, and they'd got green berries on, so there were must be the recce corps or something, and. It just happened to mention, we asked them if they wanted a cup of tea, and we mentioned that about Tripoli falling. He says, Tripoli's not falling. We're right up at the front here. We're right up with the wrecking corps. So we'd been listening to rumours. Tripoli had fallen, and it hadn't, you see. And so we stood back and waited till next morning. We moved in there next morning. There was no battery. The Germans just pulled out.
What do you remember of that when you did move?
Well, we moved straight into Tripoli.
Who were you looking for?
Now, we were looking for somebody, and nobody told me who. We'd got an address to go to. And we went there, and the place was empty. So, we got nothing to do. All this terrific preparation and driving like hell. And it was a waste of time. And so we were there, nothing to do. So we thought, we knew there was a brewery in Tripoli, so we went to the brewery. But the Highland Division had got there before us. So we went, there was a...
What were they doing?
They'd taken over the brewery, and I expect the Highland Division were going to get some beer.
They wouldn't let you in?
No, they wouldn't.
You were just looking for some beer yourself, yeah, were you?
So we got, we came away empty-handed, but we knew there was a wine that the Italian, all this wine making in Libya is done by smallholders, I think, and they take the grapes into a central wine factory, if you might call it that, a wine brewer, a winery, I suppose you call it. And we went to this, and there was this great big vats as big as this room and taller, full of wine. See? And we thought, well, so we took this place and got a, and I was told to stay and guard it. You see? And meantime, some Arabs, because some Arabs, Arabs aren't supposed to drink, are they? Some Arabs had already got in there and they'd smashed the taps, and there was wine running all over the place. And some of them smashed the taps, and you couldn't turn them off. And it was ankle deep in wine, this floor was. And we booted all the Arabs out, and I was told to guard the place.
Did you stop the taps running?
We stopped what we could, but couldn't stop them all, because the Arabs had smashed the taps, because they couldn't find the keys to open, so somehow they'd smashed them. And we chased all the Arabs out, and they went off, the others went off to see what we were going to do about this winery. And I had a drink or two. It was, you know, it wasn't mature, it was still very, very new wine. And, but I couldn't keep these Arabs out, because I went down there, it was too big to guard, and when I came back, some of us had come in and the other end helping themselves to it. So after a bit I got browned off with these, so I fired a burst over their heads, but I didn't want to hit them, so I went right up like that. Instead of just going above their heads, I just went, pointed it up in the air, and it got a pantile roof, you know. I shot them over their heads and up to the pantile roof, then walked forward a yard or two, and the roof came down on my head. And I went down, it knocked me dizzy, just didn't knock me right out, but it knocked me funny, and I saw stars, and I fell down into this wine. If there hadn't been a little bit heavier tile, I should have drowned in the wine. And I've got this bad cut, a bit of a cut on my forehead, on the top of my head, I mean, and I went to a South African hospital.
You must have been a peculiar sight, drenched in wine.
Yeah. And there's a South African doctor saw me. And he was one of these, you know, We used to call the South Africans Rommel's men. That's what the Aussies called them.
Why?
Well, they didn't perform very well, and some of them spoke just like Germans, you know. And I don't think they were... I think they were the Afrikaners, and I don't think they were very fond of us, and the Aussies weren't very fond of them. And this doctor was an Afrikaans doctor. And I don't think he was very pro-British. Because this hospital... They got Italian nurses in this hospital. It was an Italian hospital which the South Africans seemed to have taken over. And he wasn't very sympathetic. I think he thought I was kicking up a lot of fuss about this thing on my head. I don't think it was bad. But there was blood, you know, and it wouldn't stop bleeding, and I couldn't see how bad it was. And I got a very bloody face, and I think the others thought I was... in a bad way. They took me to this thing.
They came back, did they?
They were waiting whilst I went in. But he treated me as though I was kicking up a lot of fuss about nothing, just like old Ernie Hurry and the scorpion bite, you know. The scorpion up his trouser leg. But he got these nurses to give me an injection. It was most indignant. Instead of normally in the army, get them in your arm, don't you, injections? But I had to take my trousers off in front of these nurses, and they stuck it up my backside. Well, I didn't enjoy that at all, but I know I came away from there. I suppose I shouldn't have told you that story, but that is, I can remember, that's one of the things I can remember so well in the war.
Were there many people about in Tripoli?
Well, we stayed in Tripoli.
No, I mean when you first went in?
Not when we first got there. No.
So they were just stragglers, Arabs?
No, but the Arabs were living there, you see.
That's what I meant. Population in
situ? A lot of the civilians had seemed to have gone. There was more Arabs. There were civilians there, but they just carried on retreating. There were people there, but there was a lot of Arabs living there. And, of course, some of those Italians looked like Arabs. And... But then it was become the headquarters set up there and a lot of administration. And we were stationed there for a bit. I suppose 8th Army headquarters must have been there for a bit.
Did you ever see, I should ask you while you were with them, did you ever see Montgomery or anything?
Oh, yes, well, coming to him in a minute.
Okay.
We were the 8th Army headquarters. We were at Monty's thing, but he used to be sometimes further forward with TAC HQ, I think it was. It was a little bit further forward than 8th Army headquarters. And it had really become taken over. The Highland Div had completely taken over the place. And every day there was... at 4 o'clock or something in the afternoon, beating the retreat or something, bagpipes marching up and down. It was quite a fine sight, you know, lots of bullshit. And bagpipes all the time. And it was a very fine sight, I suppose. And Churchill came to have a look. And we had to go and reconnoitre the route that Churchill was going to had to go into search every house and, make it so that nobody could shoot him, murder him. And we searched every house and went onto the roofs and we were there for a week or two. And I told you, hadn't I, we were down at this Beda Latoria for a long time when I was providing wine for 8th Army headquarters. I think I told you that.
Yep.
So then we were there for a bit, but I was quite glad to get away because it was getting a bit like soldiering in England there. There was lots of bullshit. And then the army moved on again, and we followed on. And when we got to a place called Gabis, near the Gulf of Sirte, there was a little island called the Ile de Pousse. In an island of fleas or something called Djerba, which is now quite an expensive holiday resort, I think, now. And it was about 20 minutes out in a boat. We were able to... And it was right opposite the Maras line, the front line. And it was a lovely spot, which RCO, which he always took the best places for himself, but he would have definitely have gone there. But it was a risky place to be, because it was... If the battle had gone the wrong way, anybody on that island would have been a prisoner. So he sent us. I think he picked the three chaps he disliked, you know, the ones he didn't like best. There was a little sort of jetty place on the thing, and there was this sort of motorboat type of thing. It was like a great big rowing boat, fishing boat type of thing. It was strong, and got some planks across it sideways. You see the boat, there's a boat like that, and the planks across it, and we had to drive our 1500 weight onto these two planks. And then it went chug, chug, chug for about 20 minutes out to this island. And then they left us. So therefore we were completely cut off.
Was this the same three or a different...
The same three of us, yes.
And what were you meant to be doing there?
Well, this island, as you can understand, that was a way for people to get, for our, shall we say, undercover people, if you like, to get behind the lines. And I suppose the Germans could do the same thing. So we had to be there to try and stop that sort of thing. And now the other thing about this, now whether it is true or not, there's a class of Arab, a fascist Arab, which I suppose it would be because Mussolini was a fascist one, and I think some name like Distorian or something like that. And they were these fascist Arabs, and they didn't like the British, and they were still very pro-Mussolini and pro-German. And we were also told that if the battle went the wrong way, and the Germans looked like winning, we should be murdered. You know, they wouldn't... We'd no way of getting off. We'd only got to signal the mainland, come and fetch us. You know, we didn't know anybody. It was a civilian thing that took us out there. And... if the battle went the wrong way, we should have been in a mess. Well, all we did there was kept looking round to... I mean, the island was too big for three of us to spot if anybody was landing on one beach and getting off and going to another beach. It was a bit silly, really. But we used to go onto a high bit of ground every night, so we could see the front line, you know, on the Marath Mountains and that sort of thing. It was very interesting. And it was a lovely spot to be. And there was some fishermen there. And we used to get fresh fish. And there was, if there was any booze on the island, we couldn't find it. And all we could find was creme de menthe. But we were armed to the teeth. But I don't think, if the battle had gone the wrong way, I think we'd finished up either dead or prisoners of war.
Now, you mentioned the arms you carried before. The Thompson machine gun, was that you?
We had Thompson machine guns and revolvers. Oh, dear.
It's all right.
Thompson machine guns and revolvers. That's all we had.
What did you think of the Thompson? Was it a reliable weapon?
I didn't use it very much. About the only time I ever really fired it was when the roof came down on my head. But it gave you when you're on your own and out of the way places, I suppose it gave you a bit of confidence. It was quite a. But I never actually fired it in anger. I sort of threatened people with it and that sort of thing, but I never absolutely.
So what was the next step? Sort of,
then the Marath line fell and the army advanced, and we were then into Tunisia now, aren't we? And we moved into the town, went in there, we followed the army in, you know, right forward we were. Because our whole idea was to catch people who were supposed to arrest if we caught them. But they're always one jump ahead of us. When we moved into Sfax, there was you know, just as I know what it was like when people moved into Paris, people coming out, throwing flowers at you and cheering you and offering you drinks and all that sort of thing. It's rather a, it was in a much smaller way than Paris must have been. But there was lots of French girls and people coming out and cheering you, and it was one of the better sides of war, this, when you sort of relieve a town. That was quite, and we had some very nice billets there. Real nice billet. It was a nice sort of country house with a flat roof and gardens with palm trees in it. We made that our headquarters. The whole 20 of us were there. And we had a party, and we invited a lot of these French girls, or half French, half Arab they were, and French girls, to come to this party. We thought we were going to have a wonderful time, but they all brought their mothers with them. And then, I got one of these girls and got her up onto the roof, flat roof. It was lovely moonlight night and lovely desert night. I got her onto this roof, and she really was rather nice. And was a sergeant there, he came and pulled his rank on me. He came up onto the roof and sent me off somewhere on my motorbike. And he took this girl. And a few weeks later, he got the pox. But for this, he pulled his rank on me. I don't know how far I managed to get with her, but she was. I'd got her onto the roof and got her up there with a drink. And I expect her mother was downstairs. But anyway, this chap, I'm not going to mention his name, but he pulled his rank off and he sent me off. I had to go somewhere about 20 miles away to fetch something.
How long were you at Sfax?
We were there a few weeks and we were finished. Then Tunis fell and we were all allowed to take it in turns, three or four of us at a time, to go and have a look at Tunis. Then we came back and got ready to go to Malta. So we got on one of these troop landing ships. There was a tank landing. It was a great big tall thing. Not one of these flat bottom things. We went on one of those to Malta. And then we were there 3 or 4 weeks, or however long it took to start the invasion of Sicily. And that was a job I didn't like, because the whole of the headquarters for the invasion of Sicily and Italy was in Malta, in Valletta. It's a great big underground, it was a very big government building, and underneath there was a sort of cellars where all the planning was, very high security job. And I was down there, sort of vetting anybody who came in. I spent all my time saluting real top brass, all Montgomery and admirals, and goodness knows, well, that's not my cup of tea at all.
When you say vetting, what do you mean?
Well, nobody could go in there without a pass, and you're even supposed to challenge, you know, the top grade sort of people.
What were you supposed to do if Montgomery didn't have his pass or something?
I don't know, but after a bit. But we spent most of the time saluting them. I saluted people till I was fed up with it. And but there was all the top brass, Americans and everybody were there. That was no job to me. I couldn't stand that. And I didn't. Wasn't very keen on Malta. Mind, there was quite a lot of air raids. I went into one or two of those civilian air raid shelters, and it was nasty, full of women and babies, and you're better off outside.
Why didn't you like Malta?
I didn't like it, and I didn't like the Maltese. I didn't like Malta. I wouldn't like to go there for a holiday.
What didn't you like, if you see what I mean?
There was a lot of fleas and bugs. You know what I'm like for fleas and bugs. And we found one or two bars and restaurants and things like that I liked. But I didn't like Malta.